I may be in touch with people too.
Who made this play? Did you make this?
Especially about cataloging issues and about scholarship too.
Oh my God, I did.
It's okay. It's okay. I'll be Norwegian for a day. Thank you for doing that.
No one thing.
Hello, we're going to actually get started exactly on time, which is now. So welcome to the seminar on working with publishers' archives. I'm really pleased to have convened this top-notch line of presenters who will each address an aspect of working with publishers' archives. First from the room, how is the volume? From the back, good. If it's not great, I encourage everyone to move forward too, just so we visually are not seeing. We can look at all of you instead of a bunch of empty chairs. All right, so the goal of the seminar is to get you all as excited about collecting and providing access to these materials as we are, and to think about your existing collections differently. Along the way, we're going to share tips about how to organize, describe, and provide reference support for these types of collections that pertain not only to publishers' archives, but also to other large conglomerate archives that pose similar organizational and access challenges. But first, to introduce everybody and describe how we'll proceed, I'm Carla Nielsen, Curator for Literature at the Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Columbia University, where I'm responsible for building and promoting our collections related to the history of publishing. With collections ranging from Random House to the Hanging Loose Press, and in a publishing center like New York City, this provides an exciting opportunity to engage with literary scholars and publishing professionals to approach their work in new ways. James Green, who's here, is librarian at the Library Company of Philadelphia, where he's worked for over 20 years. Jim has written many books on publishing in the early Americas between the years 1680 and 1840. Much of this material has been collected in the multi-volume book series, The History of the Book in America. He will be kicking us off discussing pre-1850 publishers' archives, and then we'll wrap up the session by moderating our Q&A. Richard Oram is Associate Director and Hobby Foundation Librarian at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. He has written over 25 articles on rare books and special collections, and co-edited books on writers, libraries, and the publication firm Knopf. He will pick off where Jim leaves off and discuss library acquisition and accessioning of publishers' records in the 20th century, and with me at the end of the presentation, we'll offer tips for managing the rights and permissions requests that inevitably follow if you collect publishers' archives. Carrie Hintz began a new position as head of collection services in the Manuscripts, Archives, and Rare Book Library at Emory University in early 2015. Previously, she was head of archives processing at the Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Columbia. Carrie will discuss how archival processing standards and workflows can be optimized to respond to the challenges posed by publishers' archives, both as part of the introduction and later speaking with Lucy about working with researchers using these large and often unruly collections. Lucy Mulroney, at the end, is the curator of special collections at the Special Collections Research Center at Syracuse University, and now also interim head of that unit. Her doctoral research on Andy Warhol has brought her as a researcher into several publishers' archives, and at Syracuse, she curated an exhibit, or co-curated a large exhibition on the Grove Press in early 2013. As I mentioned, Lucy will present with Carrie about the reference and organizational challenges posed by publishers' archives with some suggestions for how to address them. And she and I will talk about some of the research done from those archives over the last 40 years and a little bit about collection development. So to recap, it's going to go introduction to publishers' archives, introduction to research done from publishers' archives from a curatorial perspective, strategies for processing these collections and for working with researchers working on them, and then a focus on the rights and permissions concerns. And we're going to end with hopefully a healthy amount of time for a Q&A moderated by Jim Green. Before we get going, I also want to thank Molly Dodson, Interim Assistant for Special Collections at the Robert B. Haas Family Arts Library at Yale University, and thank her for all of her work as our seminar committee point person for this seminar. I also want to thank our sponsor for the seminar, who is Arthur Fournier Fine and Rare Books. So thank you both. And with that, we can get underway. Jim.
Okay, thank you, Carla. In the very few minutes allotted to me, I want to say a few words about 18th and early 19th century publishers' archives. in order to provide some background to the main focus of the program, which is the more numerous publishers' archives of the late 19th and 20th centuries. These older archives are not at all numerous, at least in the United States. They include many of the most important firms of the time, Benjamin Franklin, Isaiah Thomas, and Matthew Carey, for example. But the papers of others of equal importance are lost, along with those of dozens of smaller firms. This loss is somewhat mitigated by the fact that early American publishers did much of their business with each other. So the papers of Thomas and Carey, for example, are full of correspondence with publishers whose own archives are lost. Much of this loss is due to the usual ravages of time, but there are certain features of early American publishing practice that exacerbated it. First, most firms were not corporations, but rather partnerships, which seldom outlived their founders. And records were often winnowed, scattered, or destroyed when partnerships were dissolved. The only way anything like continuity could be achieved was for the second generation of partners to buy out the first, which was something only the most successful could manage. When partnerships ended, any papers that were in bound volumes, such as account books and letter books, were much more likely to survive than individual letters, unless they were bound in scrapbooks. If the founder was famous, like Franklin, their papers might have been preserved as a self-conscious archive by their heirs. They typically placed a premium on autograph letters, and those bound letter books and account books that had survived because of their format were often thrown away because they were written by unknown clerks. If a firm was successful through several generations, with each change in partners and each move to new premises, papers not relevant to the current business were liable to be lost or destroyed. And if a firm was lucky enough to stay in the same location for a long time, the chances increased that eventually everything would be lost to fire. For example, the Harper's Fire of 1853 destroyed the only American archive that spanned a crucial period of transformation in the trade from 1820 to 1850. Even when archives are reasonably intact, they are often very hard to understand. For example, most early American publishers didn't keep a full set of double-entry books, so even they didn't know if they were making money or not until the partnership was wound up or they found themselves suddenly insolvent. Also, these businesses were so small and unbureaucratic that the most important decisions and agreements were undocumented, and most correspondence was formulaic, concerned with the what and not the why. And finally, publishers' archives, as valuable as they are, only begin to make sense when used in conjunction with other archives, the papers of authors and editors, estate inventories, insolvency petitions, newspaper advertisements, and a whole range of other sources, and in conjunction with the material evidence of the books they published and the catalogs and bibliographies that describe them.
A bit of research revealed the first and indeed the only time that IBMS has addressed this topic in general was a seminar in 1997. Regrettably, I was down the hall at my own seminar, or I would definitely have been there. Anybody in the audience there? No? It is unquestionably time to revisit that topic. For one thing, changes in the publishing world, including e-publication, the decline of academic presses, the consolidation of houses, has changed the picture radically in the last 18 years. What do we talk about when we talk about publishing records? An expansive definition would presumably include those of book, magazine, and journal publishers, including the records of periodicals, such as girl zines, but probably not newspaper morgues. An expanded definition could even include papers of literary agents, such as the massive and massively uncatalogued David Higham correspondence files at the Harry Ransom Center. In my experience, publishing archives might range from, on the small side, of records of a small magazine such as Shenandoah, which I curated at Washington Lee University many years ago, to the mid-sized McSweeney's Archive, now at the Ransom Center, to the absolutely mammoth. Knopf Incorporated is about 636 linear feet, making it one of the very largest archives that we own. Bits and pieces of such archives may be found among personal papers almost everywhere, because so many 20th century authors were involved in publishing in some way, most famously perhaps T.S. Eliot at Faber. Another reason that they end up among personal papers is because records management policies at most publishing houses are incredibly lax, meaning that some items or whole files inevitably walk away when editors do. Moving along to acquisitions issues, like authors, publishers are born, live out their lives, and eventually die, leaving their papers behind. Alternatively, and unlike authors, they may also be devoured by larger organisms. Consolidation of publishers is increasingly the case in a competitive, more than you would say cutthroat environment dominated by entities such as Amazon and increasingly large conglomerates. We know that many smaller houses, such as Random House, which originally bought up Knopf Incorporated in 1959, have been absorbed by entities such as Bertelsmann, the German behemoth, and Pearson. Small presses typically have a lifespan slightly longer than restaurants or gnats. This environment presents many opportunities for acquisitions. However, the consolidation process may lead to a loss of scholarly access to business files. Bertelsmann, for example, which owns Random House, Knopf, among many other formerly independent publishers, has a policy, I believe, of placing archives in Iron Mountain or in similar dead storage facilities. In England, there's one in Northamptonshire. And to the best of my knowledge, I'd rather be corrected on this, does not generally allow access to scholars. Though I don't mean to single out Bertelsmann, since the problem is widespread, I can say that some old hands at Knopf that I know, who I know, are concerned about the lack of records management practices and the consequent loss of the historical record. In any event, if the record is inaccessible or uncatalogued or unarranged, it is, in effect, useless to the world of knowledge.
So I don't think it's a surprise to any of us who are sitting here in this room that the past several decades of special collections sort of thoughts and management and the philosophy that underlies what we do has been swinging towards a more access-oriented model and away from sort of a strictly preservation model of stewardship of this material, and especially in the last decade since the Green and Meisner MPLP article has come out. I think that there's been a very key way of trying to think not just about this shift, but also what strategies we have for incorporating that into the work that we do, and how it affects the way that we deal with the collections that are under our control. Publishers' records are large, as Richard said. They're often living collections that are still being added to. And they include the works of many different types of agents that people are interested in. That might be literary agents, authors, graphic artists. And there's a lot of different types of records and a lot of different types of research that are happening in these. So the real question is, how do we take some of these very complicated histories of these firms and represent that in our finding aids? I think we're hitting a point where we understand that we're not going to be able to put all of this chaos into order and have to start thinking about describing the chaos. and really embracing that, especially in collections like the Random House collection, which is well over 700 linear feet, and we get additions of 200 feet at a time. There's no way to kind of look at these additions and try and shape them in or shoehorn them into the existing organization of the collection. So how do we represent these in a way that shows these are additions, they came in later, they represent a different and later part of the organization, and make it very clear? I think for a long time there was some effort to try and make everything look like one nice streamlined little flow. And so one way of dealing with additions now is to represent them very clearly as additions with their own internal logic and internal organization that's a snapshot of the organization at a particular time, and that to understand that that is going to be changing over time. Let's see. Other things that are just true in a more MPLP kind of world, collections are handled less. We're not looking at every item in these collections, so we need to describe them in the aggregate in ways that are thoughtful, that are reflective of the content, but they don't have that deep dive into individual cataloging of letters like we may have done before. So shifting that thoughtful description to the aggregate, and I think that another thing that's really important is remembering that the function of appraisal becomes even more important when you're not doing weeding at the item level while you're processing. So we need to be very conscious about what types of files we want, what we're collecting, why we're collecting them, and how we're bringing them in. There are definite advantages to this MPLP approach. I think a lot of time, this is a little finding aid from the kitchen sink press. I did some quick back of the napkin calculations, and just the first six boxes of this collection, which was already determined to be the sort of important correspondence, took 2 days to process. It was already in good condition when it came into RBML at Columbia. It would have taken about 450 hours, conservatively, to individually catalog these pieces of correspondence. So I think being able to make that shift into the aggregate description has obvious advantages in terms of the time it's taking us to work through collections. Another thing that I really want to point out is thinking through the born digital aspect. And here, I think, is where appraisal becomes a hugely big deal. We were just kind of, when we brought in the Dalkey Archive Press to Columbia, I think is a particularly good example of some of the challenges. It was the first time that we'd really brought in entire hard drives or thought about what that meant. And when we went to go and do the analysis of the actual files, not only was there a ton of duplication, but I think like 60% of the files on the machine were things like font files and things like that that we didn't purge out at the beginning. And then we had such a massive amount of material that it was very difficult for us to go through and actually figure out what we had, what we wanted, what we needed. The other problem with that is that, not problem, another thing that we failed to take into consideration in our collecting in that is that most publishers work on Mac platforms. It's a very visual platform. Most publishers, graphic designers are going to work on Macs, and we didn't have any forensic equipment that could handle those platforms, so we had to go through and sort of redesign a lot of our workflows and purchase a good amount of new hardware in order to be able to deal with it. So things like that to keep in mind and to really sort of do your homework on the front end really makes these massive collections much easier to deal with when you have a sense of what you're getting into. So now that we have a little overview of some of the key opportunities and challenges, I will turn it over to talk about the type of research that we do in these publishers' archives.
Okay, great. There's actually, you set up several things that now I don't have to say, which is wonderful. So the goal of this section is to talk about some of the types of research done from publishers' archives and along the way to describe some of the, which parts of the collection these researchers have used and how we think about a collection from the perspective of collection development. So Dalkey Archive will come up again.
So one of the most common, I would say the most common cat type of material people are looking at in publishers' archives are the, is the correspondence. And as Rich and Carrie mentioned, for years, those would actually be set aside into a cataloged correspondence series often with certain authors represented and given access points. But correspondence or author files, sales reports, information about print runs, information about some of the early marketing strategies, contracts, meeting minutes, production files. That is the last slide that I will read. And now we're increasingly having to think about, when we take in digital assets, not only the problems of having to acquire a Macintosh for our digital archivist to work with Docky Archive production files, but also with a lot of proprietary software formats, so these huge InDesign files. So understanding which of those we needed to keep if there were many, many versions of a cover, for example. Also, we were able, when we acquired the Archive of Granary Books, to get all of their email, because they had been very deliberate about archiving their email and were willing to hand over everything. So it actually became a reason to acquire that archive, is that we wanted to learn how to work with email. Also, I want to speak quickly about the importance of web archiving, and if you have access to it at your institution, setting up a schedule for web archiving of the collections that you acquire. This became very clear to me one day in December 2012. We had acquired Dalkey Archive actually very soon after I arrived at Columbia in the summer of 2012, and they posted a job announcement on their website. Began kind of very standard. The press is looking for promising candidates with an appropriate background who have already demonstrated a strong interest in literary publishing, who are willing to start at a very low level salary. But this happens in publishing. But then the requirements got increasingly ornate and possibly, you might say, bizarre. They were requested to have no other commitments, personal and professional, not to go to weddings in Rio. And the backlash was quick. Within a couple of days, articles began appearing on the web, so I quickly contacted our digital archivist and said, can we make sure to crawl this page now? It's not going to be here in a couple days. I also printed it out. So setting up those schedules is, of course, very important. All right, so the first category of research I want to talk about is bibliography and book history. The bibliographers in the room will remember Bauer's edicts that publishers' archives constitute collateral and not bibliographical evidence, and are therefore excluded from the methods that he describes. But publishers' archives are very central to other types of bibliographers, including the people sometimes described as the new bibliographers, and namely maybe D.F. McKenzie, but also Gaskell. And these new bibliographers use publishers' archives in kind of with the evidence presented by the printed book to make their arguments. So that evidence ranges from the Registry of the Stationers' Company, the equivalent of copyright in London in the 16th and 17th centuries, to these kind of large 20th century archives like Random House that Carrie was describing. I also sometimes think of something that's from Darton's communication circuit. When I make collection development decisions about publishers' archives, thinking about all of the processes that could be represented by that archive and whether they are, in fact, represented in the materials at hand. So, correspondence with authors, when that's still happening through the mail, that's represented. But sometimes you don't have any information about how that press worked with booksellers or how they otherwise distributed their work. So if I see an archive that also includes, gets a small press that also distributes other presses, that becomes a reason to try to acquire that press because it attests to this function that's not well represented in other publishers' archives. And then, for example, with the Hanging Loose Press, they're a collective that publishes small poetry books. They began at Columbia in the 1960s, so they were kind of an obvious fit, but they kept, their press members lived in different cities, and they kept these meticulous circulation slips by hand that they sent on with submitted poems, so their editorial process was just, it's extraordinarily well documented. So that was, it's bulky, but that was a reason to think about taking in that press. So Darton, of course, is an exemplary book historian. And I wanted to mention one other of his works that was done from Publishers Archives, and that is The Business of Enlightenment, which of course is about Diderot's Encyclopédie, which was both one of the most widely censored and also one of the biggest bestsellers of the 18th century. So a lot of that research was done in the archive of the Société Typographique de Neuchâtel, please excuse my French, which wonderfully has been, a good portion of it has been digitized, and there is a fantastic database with kind of some surrounding map functions that later researchers have been able to make use of, even if they can't go work with the papers. I'll just mention one other person, Jeffrey Friedman's Books Without Borders in Enlightenment Europe, which looked at this archive to think about translation of the writings of the Enlightenment figures from French into other European languages. So the second category are is biographies of presses and publishers. Some of these happen internally. So, you know, you have Bennett Cerf's At Random, Jason Epstein's The Book Business, Andre Schifrin's The Business of Books, in fact, a very different perspective than Epstein's. Epstein was at Random House and Schifrin at Pantheon and then the New Press. Richard Sievers, The Tender Hour of Twilight about Grove. Stett by Diana Eitel, who was an editor at Deutsch. I just think Stett is a great title for a memoir of an editor. And we have Eugene Exman's two books on the House of Harper, The House of Harper and Harper and Brothers. And he was a religion editor there for years. So these have some of the, you know, problems of being personal accountings and memoirs. They can get a little apologetic. They don't get into some of the facets. But luckily, there's an array of people working on this this material, including two of our panelists, Jim Green and Rich Oram, who have done work on Benjamin Franklin and Knopf. There's also Michael Winship's American Literary Publishing in the mid-19th century, focusing on Tichner and Fields, and a score of other scholars and scholar librarians who are working on this material. There's also been a popular topic for journalists, including Boris Katchka's Hothouse about Farrar-Straus Giroux, which came out just a few years ago, Tom Dardis's Firebrand, The Life of Horace Liverite. We also know that there is a new biography of Bennett Cerf being done because the researcher is in our reading room all the time, and if, yeah, and maybe yours too. And Carrie and I have joked that actually maybe the footnotes to her biography will supplement our finding aid for the Random House Archive because she is definitely getting into material that no one else has seen yet. So it's exciting if you have 7 to 10 years to dedicate to the project. But I wanted to talk about someone who's focusing on press archives within book history who might be somewhat less well known, and that's Michael Everton, who has a great book, his book, 2011 book, The Grand Course of Complaint, Authors and the Business Ethics of American Publishing. So he's done some work in our Harper and Brothers collection. And the finding aid is a little problematic. It's, for one, typewritten. You can't search it easily. We have a revision kind of underway that is helpful. But one of the documents he looks at are all of the contracts kept with authors, because what he's looking at is how authors and publishers negotiated their relationship. And he writes also just about the discourse of publishers as predatory, like are they aides to authors or are they doing their best to exploit and take advantage of authors. So in this contract, you see what their official contract language is, because that's in type. You know, the addition of the name Henry James for the work Washington Square. And then at the end, handwritten, additional clauses for money to be paid for James for the appearance of this work in Harper's Magazine. So thinking about, that shows us how the how Harper's was thinking about all of the components of its enterprise together and negotiating with Henry James, who had more negotiating power than some of the other authors in the collection, so what terms he was able to get. The last category I want to talk about are biographies of books, sometimes which I might rename social histories of works. On the screen is an image of Kevin Birmingham's The Most Dangerous Book about the publication of Ulysses. This came out in 2013 to great acclaim, in part because by focusing on one work, you know, from its appearance in Serial, in the Little Review, to the authorized Random House publication in 1934. He was able to come at Joyce in a new way, you know, Joyce's interactions with his publishers, and of course there has been so much written about Joyce, it was very welcome to have a new angle into the discussion of his literary output. And it also was a way to talk about, those series of decisions were able to overturn some of the prevailing obscenity laws that were then almost entirely overturned by over the next 30 years by another number of other publishers, including Barney Rossett at Grove. So that's a category, because there's also, you could say, Mockingbird, Charles Shield's book about Harper Lee, which really focuses on the publication of To Kill a Mockingbird. And I know that Alice Kaplan at Yale is writing a biography of Camus' The Stranger, and the competition between U.S. publishers to publish the French existentialists in translation. So that's a really fascinating category of research done. And now Lucy will talk us through three more.
So as Carla said, I'm going to add three other areas of research to those that she already listed for us. And I'll do so by going back to Darton's communication circuit. With the communication circuit, of course, it's organized around people. So you have the author and the publisher, and then the printers, the suppliers. So it's really the history of the book through the people who worked on the book. And after Darton's communication circuit. In 1993, there was a revision which he responded to in an essay entitled What is the History of the Book? And this revision has to do with kind of flipping the model. So it's not so much about the people who were involved in the sort of publication or communication circuit, but it expands the idea rather from a book to all different kinds of print documents and looks at the processes through which that book travels. So it's closer, I think, to what Carla was talking about, the sort of social history of the book. The other area that Barker and Adams point out is they address what is the survival, the end place of the publication differently than Darton did. Darton just left room for the library and the book club, but in this model we have more information that would take into account Bertelsmann and other end places, reprints, new editions of books. So taking this revision in mind, the first category of research I wanted to talk about was sort of networks, social networks, network theory. There are many scholars who look at publishers' archives for information or work with publishers. So one example would be Stephen Clay, a secret location on the Lower East Side. And below here you see the chronology, the timeline of the literary underground. So Clay went and interviewed and talked with many of the publishers of the mimeograph revolution, and that was also became an exhibition at the New York Public Library. And then, as Carla said, the Granary records are at Columbia Rare Book and Manuscript Library. So this sort of iterative process in which you're tracking the history of the publications of the mimeograph revolution, which become both an exhibition at New York Public, but a publication by Granary Books, which is now at Columbia. So this network really can be an area of exploration. And at Brown, in collaboration with University of Tulsa, they're doing a modernist journals project, which actually does visualize these networks. So rather than looking at the content of the letters, the content of the publications, the magazines, they're basically gathering all the data on where and when letters were mailed and circulated. And so this right here is one issue of a magazine entitled Others, and you can see all of the authors and which volumes. And so that kind of information is really, if scholars are looking to look at the network and the data about the network rather than the content, something like throwing away envelopes that would have stamp dates on them becomes a source of information that you might want to retain. The second area that I was going to talk about, it has to do with sort of reading histories in class and power, of course, with Janice Radway giving the opening plenary today. Wanted to point to that as an area of really ongoing research. The two books here, one is by Joan Shelley Rubin and the other by Janice Radway, both have to do with the Book of the Month Club and thinking about middlebrow culture, middlebrow reading publics, and how the middlebrow defined itself in relationship to high culture or to academic writing. And so both of these authors looked at the Book of the Month Club differently. Joan Shelley Rubin, because there's not a lot of information on the subscribers, Joan Shelley Rubin really looked at the artifacts, the criticism from academics, the reactions from the editors at the Book of the Month Club, whereas Janice Radway really took an ethnographic model. She actually went to the Book of the Month Club offices and sat in on their meetings. And so when you read her book as a curator, you think about, how can I acquire a collection that would sort of replicate the experience that she was able to obtain as an ethnographer in the publishing house? Of course, she then also did research at Columbia because they have the papers of many of the, well, both the founder and many of the editors and judges of the Book of the Month Club. And to Rich's point earlier, not only Random House, but the Book of the Month Club are now part of Bertelsmann. And so thinking about these publishing histories as part of corporate histories and what is at Iron Mountain, and where the survival point is on the communication circuit. The third area that I wanted to talk about has to do with visual culture and graphic design. For me, of course, the touchstone is Marshall McLuhan telling us the medium is the massage, that the book is an extension of the eye, and looking at how form and function work together with books and thinking of the book as a visual medium, some scholars find the publisher's archive to be very, very rich areas for this, because you can have all of the editorial discussions and marketing discussions about design, but also the mock-ups of the design, the typography. So my example here would be Lauren Glass, who wrote the first real history of the Grove Press. And he makes a very interesting argument and attends to the cover art, which was done by Roy Coleman, for the Grove Press books, and ties the modernist aesthetic that Coleman used to both the branding of Grove and the identification of Grove as avant-garde, but also the place of abstract expressionist work within the United States cultural imperialism. So he's one of the few, I think, literary scholars that's attended to the visual in this interesting way. So to go back to where Carla started us off and to add some items to her list, what materials are relevant for this kind of research that we've both been talking about? I think correspondence and contracts, subscription data and reader surveys, newspaper clippings. You might think, like, you know, the Associated Press, yeah, but you look at the Grove records and their folders and it's the same article over and over and over again, but there are slight variations, and just the fact that the Associated Press printed a review in the Fresno Bee and in the San Francisco Chronicle, and who were reading these books is very interesting. Advertisements and press releases, internal memos and design mock-ups, other businesses with whom the publisher regularly worked, corporate collaborations, coupons. When Random House published Warhol's pop-up book, they were building on a coupon they did with Maxwell Coffee, where you could get a free Bennett Cerf pop-up book with two Maxwell House like coffee can tops. Financial reports, family histories, diaries, contact lists of reviewers who received advanced copies, address books and calendars, book launch party invitations, queries from foreign publishers for translation rights, personal copies of books with annotations, and oral histories. So all things you could find, and I think researchers find very useful in publishers' collections. So now I'm going to switch. I'm the halfway person. So I'm the first to talk about the next section, which has to do with description and how we organize these collections and what impact that has on our reference work. So which lines of inquiry do particular organizational schemas or access points either facilitate or thwart? So when we organize the collection, how we organize it, how does that help suggest or facilitate researchers to go in one direction or another? So I have two examples. There are many others, but just to keep this tight here, the Street and Smith records and the American Book Company records, which are both at Syracuse University. So Street and Smith was founded in 1855. It's known as a pulp or pulp fiction dime novel publisher. They did a number of really famous publications, Doc Savage, Amazing Stories, Love Story, Shadow, and even Mademoiselle magazine. Sean Quimby is an expert on Street Smith, so if you have questions, ask him. The finding aid here for the collection, and as you can see, it's quite large, was it 407 linear feet? It's organized by series title, meaning it's organized by, as an example, Astounding Tales or Mademoiselle or Athlete, the title of the journal or the magazine, the publication, not title of article, and not by author. So what does that do? It shows us how a particular series would have been developed, but it doesn't, it makes it difficult for researchers to track particular authors across series, and that's made even more difficult because many of the authors, as you can imagine, authors who wanted to have a identity as a writer and not necessarily a pulp fiction writer, use pseudonyms. So we have an incredible number of vouchers, which is, you know, how they got paid, and they're all organized chronologically, not by author, not by title. And so in order to track someone, we do have many reference queries about who, you know, this person wrote, we knew they were a writer for Street and Smith, and maybe they used multiple pseudonyms, maybe the pseudonym was taken up by different authors. How do we help researchers track these authors through these vouchers? Another example from Street and Smith is Mademoiselle magazine. So this is a table of contents page for an issue of the magazine, and you can see editorial annotations. You can see the price that was paid for each of the articles and which articles were cut and were retained. And then there are internal memos that that give you the exact price. But again, so this gives you a great picture of the financial impact or the financial decisions that were made, the editors made, but it makes it difficult to figure out trace particular authors across across journals and across different publications of Street and Smith. My second example is the American Book Company records, also founded at the turn of the century, 1890. It was an educational book publisher. It's best known for its McGuffey readers, and also it was the first place that Norman Rockwell published an illustration, a book illustration, and Frederick Remington, many wonderful illustrators worked for this publishing house. This collection is even larger. It's 821 linear feet, and it's organized into six series, which roughly correspond to the organizational structure of the company. So that's general correspondence, business records, books, illustrations, study charts, and miscellanea. So many of these series are further organized and described through spreadsheets because it was too large for us to create a finding aid. So, for example, if you go to illustrations, you can see here, it's kind of hard, the last line in that big paragraph. Click here to get the open the spreadsheet. So if you click on that, then you get this spreadsheet. This is a spreadsheet of all the illustrations that are in the American Book Company records. They're organized by box number, package one, package two. But what you notice are there are no artist names, there are no author names, there are no book titles. It's organized by plate number. And there's a subject heading there at the end. Plate number, this is an artwork from the collection. You can see down there at the bottom, most of the illustrations, not all of them, were stamped with a number, a plate number. And you can correlate a illustration to a title through the plate number. So in our finding aid description, we do say there's a note that Norman Rockwell and Frederick Remington were illustrators for American Book Company. And I, of course, wanted to find the Rockwell illustrations. So, but I searched
Norman Rockwell, nothing came up in the finding aid. I couldn't find anything in the spreadsheet, so I went to Google, and I typed in Norman Rockwell and American Book Company, and scare quotes there, and I came up with this biography, American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell, in which it says that in 1912, Fanny Eliza Coe's history book, Founders of Our Country, was in fact the first place that one of Norman Rockwell's illustrations was published. So I then went back to the finding aid, found the series that had to do with books, searched for Coe's name. I did find it. The title of the book that has the Norman Rockwell illustrations is not in the finding aid, but it's all in one box, so I pulled box 533. Because I need to find the plate number in order to go back to the Rockwell. I did not find the plate number. I did find a letter pertaining to the book that he published, and that last paragraph there with the little caret, and you have some cursive, it does say that the book, her book, will be illustrated with appropriate illustrations, but there's no information about the plate number or further information about the illustrations. So we may have Norman Rockwell illustrations in this collection, but I'm not exactly sure how to track them down. So how do we help researchers navigate these collections and find material for which there is no clear access point or description in the finding aids? At Syracuse, we have an amazing public services unit. They are incredible. They help me go through this whole process with the American Book Company records. We have a website that, a web page that lists the different services that they provide, reference and collection retrieval. We also have a LibGuide that gives researchers the sort of handle on how to use finding aids and how to search for collections in both the catalog for printed material and in our archival collections. And our most this important tool is the general question form. It's just a reference form on the website. And what happens is those queries come in, and they come into a general email account that our public services staff manage, and every question is researched and then archived. The answers are archived. So at any point, anyone answering a further question about a collection can cross-reference that with our donor files, our records, and access the answers that we've done. I think that's the most important tool other than personal knowledge. Thank you.
All right, and I'm going to follow up on some of these sort of questions and issues that Lucy brought up about how do we make our tools more effective for us to assist researchers and for researchers to find information themselves. So a little bit more of a deeper dive into the metadata we're creating, how we can link across different collections, and how we can use our description to really aid the type of reference that people are trying to do within these collections. And one of the major things that we need to think about is how do we manage the libraries that come in with publishers' records? Often when you get the records of a publisher, you're also getting the output of that publisher. And having that all together and seeing the context and the way things change and that history of the work of the press is extremely important. And there's a lot of different ways that we can think about creating those linkages in our finding aids, in our catalogs, and in our other descriptive tools. Probably the simplest is just to manage these archivally. So for example, in this particular collection, which is again the DocuArchive Press, we decided to just create a series for the library that we got with the records. And then when we go into that, you'll see that we went through and did not real deep bibliographic description, but we have the author, we have the title, we have the edition and the printing and the year. So we do have enough information in there to help a researcher locate a title that they might be looking for and to understand which printing they're getting and the other basic tools that they need to find the the proper edition or title that they're looking for. We decided in this particular case that it was important for us, A, to expedite processing was part of it, and the cataloging process for this set of books would have been pretty intensive and taken quite a while. But we also thought because we wanted to keep these things as tightly bound, the description of these materials as tightly bound to the records as possible, and have all of that information in one form. You can also manage these types of libraries bibliographically through the catalog. There's a lot of different ways that you can go about doing that. A 561 note to just indicate the custodial history that this came in as part of the publisher's records is one way of managing that. A 590 note, a local note with agreed upon language that works across that input is another effective way. A 710 co-creator that indicates the publisher as a co-creator and can be searched individually or through a piece of a call number designation. So I promise this is, I will only show you one MARC record. So this is just one example of a 710 indicating that this is part of the, that the Black Sparrow Press is a creator of this item. The Black Sparrow Press, which is held by Emory, we have their papers and their publisher's outputs, also done through the call number, and specifically kind of shortened so that when you do a search of BLK SPRW instead of Black Sparrow, you're only pulling up the things that are part of this call number run and then getting a comprehensive list of the material that came in with the records. The other thing that we really need to think about doing is not just connecting the output of the publisher's records to the records themselves, but also back to some of these things that keep coming up about how there are pieces of publishers' records all over the place. They're in personal papers, they cross repositories, they cross institutions. So finding this content and connecting this content becomes really key. So, for example, Columbia University has the Hetty Jones papers. She was critical in helping to run Eugen and the Totem Press. So we have records related to the press, but they are not only in her personal papers, but not even in a really obvious place in the personal papers. They're under writings, even though they're sort of more business records. So being able to kind of, I have to say, having a really good search interface for your finding aids portal, whatever that may be, is really key. Having as many things up as possible in a searchable format online is really important. If they can be found through open web searches, that's really key. So we've been trying really hard to move away from some of the PDFs and things like that that had been up as finding aids, because in order to take advantage of these linkages, which are critical to finding this sort of pseudo-hidden material, search interfaces are our best friend. And also having the linking capacity we may get through something like EAD. We can also do linking across repositories. And this is a teensy tiny, I'm sure it's really hard to see, example. But Syracuse has the Grove Press records, and Columbia has the Barney Rossett papers. Barney Rossett was, of course, the great editor and publisher who ran Grove Press. And if you look at the collections, there is significant overlap between the material that's at our two repositories. To a certain extent, I feel like half of each collection is really just a photocopy of something that's in the other repository because of the record-keeping system. I was going to say the press, but really Barney's like record-keeping system. So being able to, for us to link back and forth across those things in our finding aids, I think is really key to letting researchers know where they're going to find things, especially when they come to Columbia, they look through the records, and they see entire runs of correspondence that are photocopies and not the originals. We can point them directly to the Syracuse finding aid. The next thing I'm going to do is take some of the things that Lucy was talking about these networks, and that I think a lot of digital humanities scholars are building up tools and are really interested in understanding all of these different literary networks, social networks, and how those work, and talk about how a couple of different projects that are out there are trying to take advantage of these tools and looking at ways of representing this material in slightly different ways than a typical static finding aid, or even a finding aid that links to other places, but kind of really reimagining what our descriptive tools and access tools might look like. The first one is the new New York Public Library finding aids. Let me see, I'm gonna try and actually pull this up. So this site is taking advantage of material that was already, information that was already encoded in their EAD finding aids. So this wasn't creating any additional metadata or description. It was simply finding ways to bring out the linkages that were already available in either, in any of their component level metadata or their digital objects. So if we search here for the New Yorker records, in theory, you find something. There we go. So if you pull that up, it takes everything that's in their New Yorker magazine collection right here, and then kind of branches out to digital objects, to other collections, to individuals who are also involved. So representing this as a sort of very large, in this case, network. And then if you can go down and then, where's my friend? Then go in, and we'll just use this as an example. Then go in, see how this is connected through down into Vladimir Nabokov, expand, say, George Plimpton, and then we can see people who Plimpton was corresponding with within the organization, collections he's represented in, and the ways that those overlap and connect with the records of the New Yorker. So just different ways of exploding out individuals who are connected to different collections in different ways, and trying to get a different sense of the landscape that's available within a repository, which is kind of an interesting project. And as I said, I like that it's building on data that they already have and had available. The other project is the Social Networks and Archival Context project, which is coming out of Virginia. And it's another way of thinking through social networking sort of technologies and how we can apply those to our collections. This one, however, relies on EAC-CPF, which is a totally distinct metadata standard, or data structure, rather, than what we may already be working on, and is really focused on creating, there we go, sort of robust biographical information and authority control information. But if we look at something like the Grabhorn Press, which they have as one of their bits of sample data, and this is still all very much in beta, we not only get a biographical note here, or a history note that tells us about the press, but we can see which archival collections have connections to the press, so where across the country you might find information about this press. So UC Berkeley, University of Illinois, so you can get a better sense of where to find these resources. You can also see things like the people who are indicated as in some ways being related to this, whether the press corresponded with a person or someone is associated in some way with the collection. So it's just another way of taking data that we have or metadata that's relatively straightforward to create and thinking about how we can use our description to link researchers with resources that they may not find otherwise. And then that, my screenshots in case this didn't work. So now that we know researchers can help, we can help connect researchers with the material that they want to use, we'll turn it over to Carla and Richard to talk about whether or not they're allowed to do anything with it.
And this is also a segue from, you know, some of the exciting things that are in these collections and that people have been able to do with the collections to an aspect of them that can really drive you crazy and make you wish you had never acquired them in the first place. So when you have the records of a publisher or a literary agent, sometimes you're the first place that people are looking, right, to try to follow up on a permissions request or trying to figure out who the copyright holder is. And often these are people who have never thought about this issue before, because it's not just academic researchers, it's also editorial assistants at a small literary magazine who want to reprint something. So there's a fair amount of education that one does about rights and permissions with publishers' archives.
So a couple tips for how to drive yourself less crazy. One of them is for all of the collections. I don't think I have slides for this one. For all the collections, we try to keep contact information for the last person we know who was the rights holder, and stay in touch with them on a somewhat regular basis if it's a collection for which we get many inquiries. So we get a lot of inquiries for the Souls, the publishing house controlled by Soul Stein, and so I have to, I write the address periodically and ask them for new contact information. I've also begun to ask people for the contact information for their literary agents and literary executors, and add that to the collection files that we keep. And Rich is going to mention some other places to which you could add that information. I've sometimes had to refer researchers to Publishers Weekly, which is the publishing industry magazine that will report on, for example, the sale of a backlist. So if a publisher is defunct, that doesn't mean that the original press founder will own some of the copyright. If they sold their backlist, that copyright is now with another publishing company. So as I'm setting up researchers to kind of follow that trail, often it's good to direct them to Publishers Weekly. And then I want to talk about one category of material that is very tricky, and that is literary agents' papers. And that is because of the role that literary agents play in publishing, right? Which is that they're intermediaries, and that they rely on both the publishers and the authors with whom they work to that they will keep certain information secret, perhaps in perpetuity, right? So we get these large collections from literary agents. For example, we have a lot. Who's come up most recently? Well, most recently we haven't had permissions concerns, but with Annie Laurie Williams and Maurice Crane, who were Harper Lee's literary agents. A lot of our larger collections have come with very stringent restrictions that involve that you contact the press and obtain permission. And of course, the permission is to view just a few folders in a box. And some of the agents have asked us to go through and take out everything. It becomes a very labor-intensive process. So that is something that actually you do yourself a lot of favors if you negotiate at the beginning, so with the contract when you bring in the material. And you also need to lay out that procedure very clearly for your researchers and the finding aid. We put it in red. We're trying to figure out a way to flag it in Aon at Columbia, because it's a real bummer if your researcher has traveled from afar and they show up and they think they've ordered their 20 boxes and you cannot give them access to it. So it's really important to have that that very clearly flagged. Still worth collecting the papers of literary agents, but they're perhaps an extra tricky category within the category of publishers' archives. And the last thing I want to say about rights and permissions is who should handle these requests, right? So Lucy has talked a little bit about the public services staff, and they're often the best for handling requests in a timely manner, right? They have boilerplate letters. That's something that they're checking every day. But I also think it's very useful to bring in your curatorial staff to address some of these questions. I have to say that I put together most of the programming for the Samuel Roth exhibit in 2014 based on researcher requests, people who have been doing research in the collection. So knowing about that and then being able to invite them to campus to give a talk, it's helpful. It's also helpful if you need to do additional research. We're getting a number of press inquiries right now about the Annie Laurie Williams papers, because there is some speculation about what the relationship of Ghost at a Watchman, the book that HarperCollins is releasing next month, what its relationship is to Ghost to Kill a Mockingbird. And our head of public services doesn't have time, nor should she make the time to do all that research, but I needed to do that. So thinking about who should be answering those questions and taking advantage of your CC line in email. All right, that's to Rich to talk about. The last thing I was going to talk about was someplace we point people online is to Columbia's Copyright Advisory Office. Truthfully, this is most helpful for academic researchers, because what it's really helpful for is helping someone understand if what they're using can be understood within fair use. So that is someplace that we often direct researchers. And now Rich will talk about a few more things, and then we'll move on to the Q&A.
I I just want to add that one category of materials that's very popular with non-academic researchers, particularly from literary magazines, NPR, New York Times, and so on, is rejection correspondence and rejection files. There's something fascinating about publishers making terrible mistakes, which of course, as we know, they all do. So famously, Knopf rejected Kerouac's On the Road. As you can imagine, Alfred Knopf thought it was filthy and uninteresting, and it just didn't get it. He wasn't the only publisher to feel that way. Also famously, Grove Press rejected The Hobbit. It's a sort of odd, if that had gone through, it would have been a very odd juxtaposition of subject material and publishing house, I think you'll agree. But they, for some reason, the New York Times Magazine just loves to death rejection letters, and they have cycles of about 10 years on that. But back to rights and permissions. The situation in the case with publishing, which is the case with most publishing houses, can be, especially defunct ones, can be rather complicated, as we've already heard. For example, in the case of the Knopf Archive, nobody today, even today, almost 50 years after acquisition, could be sure who owns the IP rights to Alfred and Blanche Knopf's correspondence, which is both business and personal, in the archive, and or whether is that owned by the Knopf heir, Alice Knopf, or is that owned by Knopf in Random House? So we actually recommend, in the case of that people contact both, to be sure, which is a bit of a complication, and perhaps one day that will be renegotiated. Of course, the incoming correspondence into the archive is the intellectual property, generally speaking, of the author or the author's heirs or his or her estate. Other complex situations involve defunct firms with no clear successor and no obvious copyright holder, already mentioned by Carla. Therefore, any acquisitions agreement or deed is greatly advantageous if the rights issue is clarified up front, and rights ideally would either be transferred to the repository, although that's fairly unusual in my experience, or the institution would be given carte blanche to approve routine scholarly use, with the carrot being dangled of, therefore you won't have to, your legal staff won't have to be involved with the day-to-day management of rights for what are generally, in most cases, scholarly uses. Failing that, a conduit for rights requests should be identified. At the Ransom Center, we are pleased to collaborate with the University of Reading in the watch file. You see the search screen right there on our website. This is an online database that most of you are probably familiar with. It comes out of our history of, I hesitate to bring this up, a source of some pain for older researchers is that we used to require permission of copyright holder before making any photocopies. Gave that up in 2003. Thank goodness. This site also provides guidance in identifying limited rights holders for unlisted publishers, how to go about the process, what are the major sites for researching such things. I find that most curators are aware of Watch, at least, although they may not have heard of its cohort, which is FOB, Firms Out of Business, which is conveniently here together. You don't have to search one or the other, search both. FOB is much more the work, I have to be honest, of the University of Reading than it is of a Ransom Center. It can be a very helpful source, but obviously there are lots of known unknowns, so to speak, that it cannot always resolve all the rights issues. And if we look at this entry for Alfred Knopf's mentor, Mitchell Kennerly, significant figure in early 20th century publishing, we see the DLB volume on Kennerly, the article is cited, but there is no complete resolution of the rights issues there. But in general, if the scholar makes a good faith attempt to locate the rights holder and the usual fair use tests are applied, there should be some confidence about proceeding with publication.
Okay, well, you have no idea how much planning went into getting all of that into the allotted time so that there would be some opportunity for Q&A at the end. And so this is what we've been waiting for you to speak up. We have a microphone at the front here, or bellow, I don't know which I would recommend. Who wants to go first? Yes.
My name is Arthur Fournier, and I'm actually the book dealer who sponsored this session. And I do sometimes work with Publishers Archives and other large archives that are maybe similarly complex. And I'm just wondering, I spend personally a lot of time creating inventories, photographing items, trying to come up with file formats for those images and documents show them to special collections departments and other repositories so that they can understand what might be on offer if they were to take on an acquisition. And I'm just wondering if you have any advice for people in my role about creating actual, you know, not just selling the property, but selling the property along with a set of data that's useful for you so there isn't a duplication of efforts. And if you've ever thought about how you might be able to issue a set of standards or, you know, or even advice, even informally, to the book trade about how to do this in a way that's effective and helpful for archivists and rare book librarians. Thank you.
I mean, first, is that on? Yeah. First of all, I just kind of want to like blow you kisses for doing that, because that is massively helpful for us. And I think the example that Carla brought up earlier of the Granary books, that's an example of we got a full inventory with that collection when Columbia acquired it, which really meant that there was some reboxing into archival housing that we needed to do. But so much of the description was already done that we were able to use students to do that reboxing, professionals to go in and do some double checking, and to get the time between acquisition and the finding aid being up and online and that collection totally open was
4 months.
Yeah, which for a very large publisher's archive with mostly students doing this part-time was extremely fast. So I'm not sure that I have a ton of thoughts about how we could build a standard around that, but certainly coming up, like having that set of data, the inventories that go along with that, the different formats, and a sense of sort of if you see something in situ that we wouldn't, some of the context around what it looks like in the office, how it's used, how the different files are used, if a piece of it is coming from a particular editor's desk instead of the central filing cabinet. Those types of contextual clues are just as helpful for us as the inventory, but that does make your product a little bit more appealing to those of us who might be thinking about purchasing it. It's hugely helpful.
If I could follow up on that, now for the bad news. Publishers Archives, as you probably know, are a tough sell because of their size and their lack of density in terms of you have to go
through a great deal of material to find the gems. Although, as we've all discussed today, scholars are now becoming much more aware of the context of the gems and its value. But I can think of an example that you may know of, a leftist publisher's archive that was quite extensive. It was offered as it should have been as a large grouping, a very prominent large British library, not to mention any names, turned it down because for financial reasons and bulk also. And to make a long story short, it eventually ended up being broken down. And in fact, almost the entire value of the archive was in a single author's correspondence within that archive. So I think it's great that you are still hanging in there and marketing these things.
Hi, I'm Jeff Martin, cataloger at Princeton, and so I hope to review the MAS who should catalog related question. I was interested when you talked about managing your collection bibliographically as opposed to archival and book collection. Could you talk a little bit about how satisfactorily those two options work?
Yeah, and I'll say that I think part of that depends on the researcher and the question that they're trying to ask, which I think if someone is studying the output of the press as a whole, it's much more effective to be able to ask for a box and get the 50 books that are in the box and to be able to see that all together and to be able to do those comparisons, which we would not necessarily have, the researcher wouldn't have the opportunity to do calling things individually. Gosh, those would be some unhappy pages who were bringing in 50 books at a time. So I think that really that does tend to be the amount of time that you're doing in inputting that material to create that list is much faster. So time-wise, that's definitely a much quicker way to go. And again, I think the research question depends a little bit. You know, you're not putting in, if you're interested in this book because of the illustrator, and if we cataloged it as an individual item and included that illustrator information in the catalog record, but that doesn't translate because we're thinking of it as part of the publisher's archive, then you're not going to be super excited about having the level of description that you have. But I think for most of our researchers, and certainly the researchers who've been specifically interested in it as the output of the publisher, the box list works just fine. People have been really happy with that, have been able to use it, have been able to find material. And because those finding aids are fully web searchable, people are coming to that item through a simple Google search, which they might not be able to do if it was if this was in the catalog. So it depends a little bit, but I personally think that for the amount of time that you're putting in and what people need to get out of it, we've had really great success with just doing box lists.
Yeah, and I would, I think that was a great explanation, but I would also add that there are a couple of cases where we have done a combination where most of the output goes into the archival collection and is boxed, and then we just have a list of titles, but those particular books, especially if they're inscribed or they're otherwise, there's something copy specific about them, they will get a catalog record and then be put on a shelf. They will be linked back to the collection, you know, part of Bennett Cerf's library, but we definitely have done both in many cases.
I'm Mike Kelly from Amherst College. I'm curious, I'll give you the background. Amherst has the archives of Samuel French, Inc. And I'd like to hear from you guys on working with the archives of firms that are still active money-making businesses. Because as we've been working with Samuel French and started processing the archive, we're sharing with them like, oh my gosh, we found these great things from the 1850s. We found these great things from the 1870s. And their immediate reaction is almost always, we'll put those together and we can, they want to repackage and resell these things. And so how to, and then there's the other, you know, it's a live business. We have 22 file cabinets of their author contracts, which we are not allowed to show to anybody yet. So just any thoughts that you have on how you deal with, they're a business, they're into it to make money and we're not, and just how to balance those competing impulses.
We have a similar situation in that Grove Press is still a publisher, Grove Atlantic. And I think the advice that I think all three of you made about having these conversations up front or even renewing the conversation, because we do have many requests if something is going to be reprinted or what was the contract with Roy Coleman or with a particular author or whoever. And so we do end up finding ourselves in a reactionary position needing to provide photocopies or doing research for the publisher, and that can take up a lot of time. So I think I don't have the answer for what to do, but I think there should be a discussion, and if it can happen, you know, earlier rather than later, about what you feel is within the purview of the taking care of the collection and not becoming a branch of the business is important. I don't know if anyone has more specific advice.
Yeah, or even, you know, less glamorously becoming the storage house for the collection. So, right, so at with our Curtis Brown Archive, I mean, they're still an operating literary agency. And when we wanted to negotiate with them how their restrictions were handled, at one point we did have to remind them that it would be very expensive to house those 2,000 boxes elsewhere. Which so I think you have to be both collaborative and work with them, but then also assert what your mission is. You know, if we can't provide access to this material, there is no reason for us to house so much of it. So I think sometimes it's being a little tough and standing up for what's at stake for you.
Is there a terminal date on the contract restriction?
Yeah, they put 95 years on it.
From
point of donation. We did do some good, what we thought was good negotiating. I mean, that's, you know, It was a great opportunity because they were moving offices in New York and they needed to get the stuff out. And it was kind of like, well, there's no way we're not going to take these 22 file cabinets. I mean, it's thousands upon thousands upon thousands of contracts. And some of them are still active. I mean, that's kind of the thing. And the other thing that we've realized, and you guys touched on this too, is that, and actually it kind of goes back to what Jim was saying, like, the Samuel French archives are just a mess. And we are still, I mean, we have 600 cartons, and they are kind of relying on us to tell them what we have. They started giving it to Amherst in 1964, and gifts came annually, and they're still coming. And so this is something that I inherited, and we're trying to, like, I mean, I think we need to keep having these conversations, but there are contracts that are very active. They don't want people to know how much they paid for, you know, X, Y, or Z. But hopefully somebody 100 years from now is going to be really happy that they have all that information. So I mean, it's a mess, but it's an awesome mess.
Yeah. One piece of advice I would give is that if you can be very articulate and firm about what your general policies are for researchers and try and hold them to those same duplication request and reading room usage policies so that you don't end up breaking your rules, because I think that's where it can get a little messy.
Thank you. Is everyone being able to hear the discussion if it's not at the microphone? Is everything all right with that? Okay, good.
Hi, I'm David Gary from Yale University, and I have a question about forward thinking in collecting publishers' archives. So we've talked a lot about formal publisher archives today, big archives. What about some of the smaller publisher archives that exist? So I'm thinking of something like Videoscope, which is a magazine published in a basement in Long Island by a gentleman named Joe Kane, who talks about movies. He told me he has all of his files going back from 1993 to present. It's not a gigantic archive, but it's sort of a moment in publishing that I don't think is very often in archives. And I wonder if anybody on the panel knows about people who think about that, or if you guys think about stuff like that. Thank you.
We have some really small collections. Do you want to talk about some of those?
Sure. We do have some small collections, and I love to think of, you know, going to the art book fair at PS1, and it happens every year in September, and you see all of these independent, you know, publishers, maybe half a step up from zinesters, and, you know, I have talked to a few of them, and I would like to pursue more finding out, you know, what do they have? Do they have something that could fit into this rubric of a publisher's archive? And I think that would be one, you know, we should be actively looking at people who are publishing in all different kinds of modes trying to collect that. Where we've had it before, the precedent for it in special collections at Syracuse is, I'd say, with the Amiri Baraka or Diane DePrima collections, where it is actually a poet's papers, and they were, you know, publishing their friends, and so some of our publishers' archives are actually a writer's papers, and they're nested within that. And so if this is someone who's a writer or an author or a interviewer, filmmaker that has a sort of side project as a publication, I would actually think about, is this someone whose papers we want to acquire, and that this is a facet of their production that we, one facet of many that we want to preserve.
I might add quickly something that relates to both Mike's question and your question, David, which is with the press that's still in operation, they can be very scary for an institution because you don't know how long or bulky their run is going to be. So one of the reasons we acquired the last 25 years of the Dahlke Archive Press papers is that Stanford acquired the first 20 and then thought, you know, surely this is an impossible business model, like they're going to go out of business within a decade, and then they didn't, interested in continuing to collect them, especially after certain authors dropped off their list. So, I mean, with this very small presses, very small operations, that wouldn't be as much of a factor, but with ongoing companies in general, it is. Yeah.
And I think that most of the people whose papers or collections, businesses we acquire, they're not thinking about their material in the same way that we are, or even that researchers are. So if you can have that discussion with them and say, like, what are you doing? And how do you, you know, mail this stuff out? And where do you keep your contact list? And sort of get them thinking about all these pieces that you would want to acquire. Then you don't have to make that acquisition right on the spot, but you can at least make sure that they're not throwing away the things, or just, you know, not even telling you about some materials that you would find really fascinating.
I can add too that I know Peter Hamphill know the Kelsey Street Press archive at the Bancroft, and I worked at that press for many years. And once that Bancroft acquired their archive, I have to say our filing got much more comprehensive and neater. So there is something about getting your creators to start thinking archivally that is a counter to what I said before. You know, like a reason to start a conversation with them while the press is still in operation.
I'm Heather Dean. I work at the University of Victoria, and I just wanted to make a quick plug, and maybe you're already aware of Laura Miller's The Story Behind the Book, where she's actually writing for publishers and for authors to think about their archives. And so I think that that would be a helpful point of conversation for our community and then the publishing community. And then the question I have is, I'm curious if you've noticed a pattern when publishers tend to want or be interested in donating material to collections, because when I've talked to others about other, like, authors, their cycles, so like biographers tend to be interested in donating material after they've written a book. Poets, for some reason, tend to be on 5-year cycles, I understand. And I'm just kind of curious if you've seen any patterns emerge with the publishing industry, if any.
Well, the cycles that Rich could speak about, right, he has spoken some about, right, about when the conglomeratization happened, which really begins in the 1970s, that changes everything. But I think before, and this affects, you know, part of why, you know, the Grove Press Archive arrived at Syracuse, you run out of filing cabinets. right? And that's what, while everything was still on paper, that was the threshold at which you would decide, oh, maybe we should look into finding an institution to take on part of our archive. A lot of it seems to be precipitated by moves, moving offices, or space concerns. I don't know if that breaks down by 5-year increments, but.
So what'll happen when the archives are entirely digital?
Server space.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But are you finding firms already saying we need to donate archives because we're running out of server space?
I haven't had that conversation. I'm thinking forward.
Did I see a hand back there? No. I do hope that, it's a wonderful thing to be able to have these archives, and once they're gone forever. I guess that's what I would say. And that do you have any, there's been a lot of interest in the questions about the process of acquiring publishers' archives. Very often it seems to be something that the publisher comes to you and you have to decide whether you can take it on. But does anyone have any suggestions about going out and actually, drumming up business, finding archives? To Carla, do you have something to say about that?
They're never bummed to hear from you. It took me a while to work up the courage to just cold call at all, across the board. But the publishers have been the most amenable to just, a visit to their place, taking a look at the shape, the condition that the material is in. Sometimes it's been so overwhelming, like a whole house with 30 years of acquired material from someone who ran their publishing operation out of their house, and that's one visit, and that's the end of that relationship. I think that being active about it, maybe the identifying what types of collections your institution should be collecting, because there's so much out there, whether it's going to be a regional focus or a genre focus, a focus on pulp maybe, or a focus on reprints, focus on translation. So deciding what types of archives your institution is going to specialize in, that might also dovetail with other collecting strengths, right? So the reason we get the Kitchen Sink Press archive at Columbia is because we're beginning to collect comics and have a strength in publishers' archives. So thinking about your collection development that way, I would say.
Right. One more. Peter, last question.
I'm Peter Hahn from Bancroft Library, and this is more of an observation and a caveat. The loss of archives, which was alluded to in the presentations with the great mergers of the publishing houses, came home to me. Most of you will know that I'm a specialist in L. Frank Baum and The Wizard of Oz. Long years after I had been doing research with the bankruptcy records, which is another source of publishers' history, I got curious about what had survived at the Riley and Lee Company in Chicago, and I called the successor, which was called, I forgot the name of the company, but Harvey Plotnick, who was a regent for the University of Chicago or a trustee, it was called Contemporary Books. So I tracked down Contemporary Books, the successor to Riley Lee, and discovered that McGraw-Hill, 18 months before I called, had taken over Contemporary Books so that it could have an educational arm in Chicago. Their CPA went out to the warehouse, which was complete for the Riley and Britton archive, and decided it had no business value, and it was trashed. Just 18 months before I got curious about it. So I would suggest that all of us who are interested in this pay attention in the press to projected mergers, because that might be an opportunity to reach out and latch on to collections. And one other thing is that since we know that there are relatively few of us interested in the field and collecting, do what I think I succeeded in doing. I was approached at Bancroft about the archive at the Ballantine Press. And I called Mike Ryan and said, doesn't this belong in New York rather than in California? And he said, I think so. So I think it did go to you. But I think we need to refer to each other and lean on each other to take in things responsibly where it's more appropriate.
Well, what a great note to end on. So talk to each other, be fearless, go out and get those archives before they're gone forever. Thank you to all of our speakers and to you for your
Arthur.